Hi, I'm Dr. Elizabeth Sanders, a foot and ankle surgeon and assistant professor at Boston University Medical Center.
Hi, I'm Katrina Sanders. I'm a registered dental hygienist, consultant, international speaker, and wine lover.
And we're sisters. I grew up looking up to my big sister, Katrina.
And now I look up to my lady boss, physician sister, Elizabeth.
Together, we are working to unite the dental and medical communities in unique and exciting ways.
Welcome to Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters, our monthly podcast,
where we unpack all things health-related from your mouth to your toes.
So, grab your flossy flops
and slide on some flippy floppies.
And let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Floss and Flip Flops with your favorite sisters, the Ginger Sanders Sisters. Hello, Dr. Sanders. How are you today?
I'm so good because the weather is absolutely beautiful here in Boston, finally, right? It's finally spring, but you know what that means.
What?
That means traumas. Right? That's what I'm told by these trauma surgeons.
Look at you smiling and giggling, you crazy surgeon, you. Are you telling me you like traumas?
Well, we do make a living off of it, but ultimately, that's what this podcast is about and what we're here to talk about. And I'm really excited to have this attendee, Dr. Sabrina Sanchez, one of my mentors and my colleagues. I think it's going to be a great podcast to celebrate or rather commemorate Trauma Awareness Month. Yeah. So welcome, Dr. Sanchez.
Welcome. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're so excited. This is interesting. You know, this is the first time, Elizabeth, that we've talked about something that I'm going to say this incorrectly, preventively has been out of our circle of control as healthcare workers. Now, I think we're going to talk about the prevention of trauma, the prevention of falls and things like that. It isn't lost on us that there are things that we can do to identify those at-risk individuals. But when you take a look at the top 10 causes of death across the United States, 9 of them are chronic diseases, or in 2020, of course, SARS-CoV-2/pneumonia. The 10th, or the one outlier, is traumas, accidents, things that happen. And so it oftentimes kind of gets missed, I think, in a lot of like what we think about on the dental side. But it's incredible the amount of excessive trauma that you on the healthcare side experience. So let's dive into this. Let's talk all things trauma. Let's just get started, shall we?
Yeah. I think Dr. Sanchez is the perfect person to bring on this podcast to talk about it. Dr. Sanchez and I, we work at a level one trauma center. And Dr. Sanchez is a trauma and acute care surgeon, but also a surgical intensivist. So we've worked together on patients just in the acute trauma setting, but also kind of in the aftermath. Dr. Sanchez, you're also a big advocate for patient-centered care, for acute care, justice and equity in surgery, but also for geriatrics and palliative care, but also diversity and inclusion and faculty development. So even though, you know, I do still see you kind of running around and treating these acute traumas, still Dr. Sanchez does a lot at Boston Medical Center. And I think my first question, and I know you, because you do so much at Boston Medical Center, but what got you specifically into trauma and acute care in this particular setting? What got you into it? Because I do think that you trauma surgeons, you're a different breed.
What was your childhood like that you're like, I know, yippee skippy, this is what
way.
I'm going to do.
I actually thought I was going to be a neurologist or a psychiatrist when I went into medical school. So it was almost a surprise to me that I ended up doing surgery, but I did my third year medical school rotation and I loved it. And then throughout residency, you know, you explore different things, but in the end, there's a lot of things that go into what specialty you pick, but for me, I really think it was number one, the people. I got this feeling when I was doing my acute care surgery and my trauma rotations that the attendings that I was working with, the residents that I was working with, or my senior residents that were going into it, the fellows, it felt comfortable. It felt like I found my people, So that was the big part of it. I also think that the way that you deal with trauma on a day-to-day basis, it's a very unpredictable environment. And there's some surgeons that really, really hate that. And they want to have a very specific schedule and know exactly what surgeries they're going to do every day and the patients that they're going to see every day. And that was actually something that did not appeal to me, knowing every day that I was going to be doing the exact same thing over and over again. I wanted to have the variety and the unpredictability of it. I also think people that like multitasking and that enjoy doing multiple things at once and triaging and having to decide, okay, I have 10 things to do, which one is the most important one, kind of get called to trauma because you have to do that every day, right? All the time it's about triaging and taking care of what's most important first, and then, knowing the things that you're able to kind of put in the back burner until you have a little bit more time to deal with them. So lots of reasons. I think another big one is that the kind of patient interactions that you have in the acute setting are very different than the interactions that you have for elective patients that you see in clinic. People usually think about it as having more of a relationship with the patients that you see electively. You meet them in clinic and you talk about operations, and then you see them for the operation, and then you see them on post-op care. So you actually do have more time to develop relationship with those patients, but the intensity of a traumatic injury or an acute care surgery problem requires that you develop a relationship with a patient very quickly, in a lot of times a very high stakes situation. And I enjoy being able to be there for patients that are in the worst day of their lives, potentially. And even though they've just met me, being able to develop a relationship with them that allows them to trust me to take care of them. On the flip side of that is that I also spend time in the intensive care unit, like Dr. Sanders mentioned. And that's actually the opposite. When you're in the intensive care unit, you spend a lot of time, maybe not necessarily with a patient if they're critically ill, right? You can develop a relationship with them, but you can spend a lot of time developing a relationship with their families. And that's really nice, right? Because it does allow you to have more time to sit down and really talk to families and patients, if they're able to, about really important things over a prolonged period of time, usually day after day after day. So I like the variety. I like that I can develop really meaningful relationship with patients, even though it's not the stereotypical relationship that people imagine, patients have with their surgeons. And it's fun too. So
It's fun.
it's so intriguing working with you and the other trauma surgeons. For example, I could be waiting in the OR for a trauma surgeon, and let's say you come in and you'll be like, "Oh, so sorry I'm late. It's just that the patient that I just saw passed away from a gunshot wound, but I'm here to help the patient who's on the OR table now." And I just think it's so intriguing how, I'm not going to say you're bipolar, but you as trauma surgeons can simply be exposed to one particular thing, and then you have to shut that out and then move on to the next, because that's how it is at a level one trauma center. Can you go through what goes on in your mind? Is there a certain way that you've learned or been able to process what you just experienced to then move on to the next person that needs your help?
Yeah, so obviously everybody's going to be a little bit different in how they do that. But for me personally, it is not it is not that common that we have patients that do really poorly, right? It's not like we are constantly seeing people in horrendous situations or that die or, right? But it does happen to us more commonly than it happens to almost everybody else, right? Other than
definitely more than me
attending, right?
Or Katrina.
Like a medical ICU or a cardiovascular ICU, you know, we probably see some of the most deaths in the hospital. And I think part of it is just the fact that you have to do it, right? Like, if it's not you, then who, right? If you are not there for the next patient that comes in, who's going to be there for the next patient? Like, you have to do it. You have to pull yourself together and move on to the next patient. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't process it, right? But you process it potentially at a different time than where most people think it needs to be processed, right? It's not like if I'm in the operating room and my patient dies, which has happened. It doesn't happen, again, that often, but it happens more than it happens to any other surgeon. I know, just a good thing. Sometimes you are able to go to your office and decompress and talk to somebody about it. Sometimes you have another trauma that comes in right away. And at that point, what I compartmentalize. I say, okay, this patient died. I'm going to deal with it, but I'm not going to deal with it right now because I have another patient that is still alive that I need to go and take care of right now. And there's nobody else that can do it by me. And then once your shift is over, then you deal with it, right? You talk to your partners. And when I say your partners, I mean your partners at work. You know, you can also talk to your partners at home, right? Or your partner at home. You talk to friends. You talk to a therapist, right? However it is that people process these things. Everybody does it differently. But I think the common thread amongst all trauma surgeons is that if you don't have time to process it right then and there, you block it off and you move to the next patient. And when you do have the time to process it, that's when you deal with it.
That's such a noble thing, I will say. And so the dental hygienist listening, when you get a 9 a.m. patient and they're mean and they decline their fluoride treatment, and then you got to go on to your 10 o'clock patient, just know that there are trauma surgeons out there who just did a call to time of death and then moved on to the next thing, right? I mean, that there's such a humanistic quality to what we do, and yet you've found a way to finesse the switch that gets turned off temporarily, because I mean, it's, you're still a human, you process it. And I think that's such a beautiful thing. I think one of the voids that we have experienced inside of certainly the medical space and the dental space is the compassion fatigue that comes along with the consistency of those traumas, whether they're deaths or whether they're extreme. Elizabeth amputates people's limbs. I mean, there's trauma associated with, you know, telling somebody you're not going to have a limb, you know, or some of those things. So there is trauma inside of everything, death being, of course, the most horrendous of those. But I think people could also say that right in that same alignment is telling, you know, a young wife that her husband is going to be in a vegetative state and will, right. You know, I mean, just all of those things. Will you do me a favor? And I apologize for having to rewind this a little bit, but will you walk through what trauma means to the healthcare community? What kind of traumas are we talking about? Because I will tell you, in the dental space, the most traumatic thing that we see is a patient who got in a car accident. They weren't wearing their seatbelt, face hits the front dash. They've got a bunch of broken teeth. You know, that's not their priority. They go and they get their face looked at by a trauma surgeon, you know, all of those things. And then eventually they come to dentistry and then we deal with putting implants in or whatever we're doing. That's the most traumatic thing we see. So what does trauma mean for the healthcare space? What is that spectrum of types of traumas that you'll see?
literally any kind of externally inflicted injury counts as a trauma. Now, that doesn't mean that I see all those patients, right? If you like are walking down the stairs and like you twist your ankle and you break it, I'm probably not going to see, right? Unless you actually continue to fall down the stairs and go down like 25 steps and like end up on the ground. If you just kind of trip and like break your ankle, I'm probably not going to see that trauma, right? And the emergency department is going to deal with that, and they're going to call an orthopedic surgeon if they need it, you know. But anything ranging from a sprained ankle to, you know, abrasions from, I don't know, gardening, right?
Mm-hmm.
To gunshot wounds and pedestrians that I hit by cars and bike accidents, falls downstairs, falls out of windows, jumps out of bridges, any kind of, like I said, externally inflicted injury counts as a trauma. So you see like the entire like gamut of things. The other thing that I think a lot of times people don't think about is burns as a traumatic injury.
Oh.
I think that's because burns are like, there's burn surgeons, right? Like it's a different specialty, but they're very interrelated. So at BMC, for example, we don't have burn surgeons. So the trauma surgeon would be the surgeon that would take care of a burn injury, you know, at least to stabilize it until I can go to a burn center. But again, it's an externally caused, you know, injury.
Sure.
So a burn is a trauma.
Now, inside of these traumas, you are a mandated reporter. So can we talk a little bit about the times where these traumas are intentionally self-inflicted and or perhaps some kind of an abuse, elder abuse, child abuse, partner, spousal abuse? What is your role inside of that? I mean, you're on the trauma side. So I'm just like, I'm going to go back to like ER for a second, like ER or Grey's Anatomy, right? Like I'm picturing like, you know, blood pressure is over one, go in and push this. We need a trauma surgeon. And then like you come in and you're like, did somebody say trauma surgeon?
And then you come in,
jazz hands. You're like, yes, you know, and then you go in and you do the thing, right? I mean, how involved is the trauma surgeon in kind of the CSI, the forensics, for lack of a better term, of, okay, this doesn't seem right, or, okay, there's a little bit more going on here. And how involved are you in that? What does that process look like for you?
So the first thing I'll say is that we definitely work in very close collaboration with the emergency department on things like that. And it depends on the kind of injury and the suspicion for there being an intentionality to it, right? I think the things that you mentioned, you know, specific assault, right, to either domestic violence or elder abuse or child abuse, that is something that we work very closely with the emergency department. In the case of child concerns, we work very closely with pediatrics. When it comes to things like stab wounds and gunshot wounds, that is, I think, more squarely in our purview, because most of the, like, almost invariably we get consulted for that. There may be instances of other, like, elderly concerns or certain assaults that maybe we're not consulted on. But for the most part, anybody that has a penetrating injury, whether from a stab or a gunshot, we do get consulted on. I will say that for those, we cannot determine intent based on pattern of injuries, right? So we are able to say, this is what we see, and this is the amount of injury that it has caused, but we can't determine, you know, somebody did this on purpose versus not, right? So like, we, if somebody shot, we can say, these are the number of bullet holes we've seen. These are the organs that were injured. The patient is critically ill or not critically ill or whatever it is, but we can't say anything else beyond that. So if we ever get called to testify in court, right, we can say, yes, this person died as a result of their injuries, or yes, this person is suffering these deficits or sequela from their injury, but we can't say, and this was obviously,
and they did it, the yeah, opposite, right? This person did it, yeah,
right, this person did
it. We that, say the week after OJ Simpson passed away, so
right.
I appreciate that, but you are brought in and asked, or your clinical notes are used as evidence.
Yes, and there will be times where I can think of a specific instance. I had a case where there was concern because of the injury pattern from some people that maybe there was some sort of abuse situation. And obviously, I don't want to give specifics. But,
of course, yeah.
But there was concern, right? And pediatrics was involved and the emergency department was involved. And they were trying to decide, is this something that we need to report? Is this something that needs to be reported to Child Protective Services? Or do we believe the child that's saying, I had this random accident and I had this injury and it has nothing to do, you know, like I just had a random accident.
Right.
And I will say that I took that patient to the operating room. I examined them. And afterwards, I was able to say, you know, the way that this looks is very much consistent with what the patient is saying happened and not consistent with what everybody else is worrying about, which is a situation of abuse. Now, could I say that for sure? No, but there was a concern raised and I was able to go to the operating room, do an exam and say, this is very much consistent with the freak accident that this patient said they had. And we had a multidisciplinary meeting with the emergency department and pediatrics. And, you know, I was there and social work and case management. And we decided, hey, this is not something that needs to be reported, which I think was very important because we were able to save a family from potentially a very horrendous investigation that I am sure would have turned out negative.
Yeah,
but still is putting a family through it. So I do think that sometimes we do have a little bit more of a role. It's not very common, but sometimes we do.
And I'll say we at Boston Medical Center, we have a tremendous amount of resources. It's unbelievable just to help with people in the recovery of these types of traumas, from social work to the nurses, to other teams, to medicine. It's really unbelievable and really great. Kind of what you talked about as well, that you do also manage your patients in the intensive care unit as well. But also a lot of the times I know you do follow them in clinic afterward. So you kind of get to see them and you get to see the process. And not only are we going to talk about trauma with the patient themselves, but we also have to remember that not only does it involve the patient, but also their families and the caregivers and the people that now have to take care of the patient that then moves on from hopefully from the SICU to rehab to hopefully to home. Mm-hmm. I would say where Katrina and I probably see these types of, I mean, I do see the patients a lot of the times in the hospital, but also where Katrina and I may see them in a clinical setting would be maybe in our clinic. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll ask, you know, hey, Bob, like how is everything going? And they'll say, oh, I was in a car accident 2 weeks ago and I was in the hospital for an entire week. And a lot of the times they'll kind of just want to vent to us and just talk about what happened. Do either of you have any advice on, you know, things that you do to kind of comfort them in the setting? I mean, a lot of what I do is to try to just listen to them and maybe just talk to them about what they're going on through the process and ask about their family. But remember that we're also dealing with the aftermath of what happened. Is there anything that either of you do in that particular setting just to give advice to your patient?
So has either one of you heard of the concept of trauma-informed care?
No.
Okay. So trauma-informed care takes into account the traumatic events that patients have had in their lives and how that may influence their behavior and their perception of the healthcare system and the care that they're receiving. And I think for any patient that has been traumatically injured, keeping in mind that they may be significantly affected by the trauma beyond their physical injuries, and providing what's called a trauma-informed care approach to them is incredibly important. And there are a lot of resources where people can read about trauma-informed care. The American College of Surgeons is coming out with some specific, not necessarily guidelines, but kind of like a toolkit and some resources to help providers learn about trauma-informed care. But I think really the real heart of it is keeping in mind that trauma can affect us all differently and in very different ways, and that we need to be open to the way that different patients will react to their trauma and their traumatic event, and be not non-judgmental and support them through it. So what you're mentioning, you know, with a patient coming in, oh, I was hit by a car, I was in the hospital for a week, you know, and they just want to talk about it. That's actually probably one of the healthiest ways that people have of responding to a traumatic event. But there may be people that maybe respond to a traumatic event by not leaving their house for months at a time, right? And maybe they show up to you with significantly advanced disease, right? Maybe they haven't had a cleaning in the last 8 years because they are not able to get in a car because they had this horrendous car accident and they just can't bring themselves to do it, right? Or they don't take care of their other medical problems and it causes their diabetes to progress. And they come to you with like diabetic foot ulcers that are completely out of control, right? And I think sometimes we go towards the, what took you 8 years to come to get a
the judgment. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
That's such an easy path, isn't it? For us, I've been here on the dental side. We've been calling you. We've been texting you. Why are you not, you know, you're right. That judgment is so easy.
Yeah. So keeping that in mind. And the good thing I think about trauma-informed care is that it doesn't necessarily just look at physical trauma injuries that patients have incurred, which obviously is something that we know will obviously affect somebody. But you can think of trauma as, I mean, if you're a family member of somebody that was shot and killed, that's a traumatic event in your life that is going to affect the way that you respond to almost everything, right? For the rest of your life. So a mother that has had a child be severely injured may be in the exact same situation of not taking care of themselves, you know, or coming into your clinic and being incredibly demanding and not wanting their child to be in any pain whatsoever. And, you know, of course, we're not going to do this dental cleaning because the noise is horrible and it's, you know, causing my child to like having some. Like that is all a response to what's already happened in the past. So keeping that in mind as we are treating patients and trying to remember the things that have happened to them that may be informing, you know, causing them to act in specific ways with us, I think is very important. So again, if it's somebody that wants to talk to you about it, talk about it. That's great. You know, it's really more the patients that don't and that maybe act in different ways that we find, I don't know, annoying, frustrating,
Sure.
that we don't understand, right? That we really need to make an effort to try to understand.
That was so well said. Thank you for sharing that and giving insight. Again, the dental providers who are listening to this, you're driving to work in the morning, whatever's going on, you know, I think all of us, as you were sharing that, you know, I started to almost walk through the filing cabinet of the patient experiences where it's like, yeah, like one experience really sits out in my mind. I had these two twin girls who were routine patients of mine. They were young. They were like 6 years old, and they had some kind of a very obscure autoimmune condition where once a week they had to receive IVIG. And so, you know, it's amazing how this happens. They're twin girls. One of the twins was the brave one, you know, and she'd go in and she'd get her IVIG, and they'd have to have the, we'd have to time out their dental care around that as well. Like, when did you get your immunoglobulins, all that jazz. And the other twin was just petrified of everything. I mean, if you can think, like, 6 years old and once a week, you can't go on a week-long trip to Disneyland because you can't be that far away from your source to get your IVIG. Like, it's crazy. And so, you know, you think about those things, and you know, this poor pumpkin was just absolutely petrified being in a dental office. Well, we wear scrubs just like the medical community, and it seems scary and whatever, you know. So you know, I think so many of us are starting to kind of think through some of the traumas that have happened. I will say, in dentistry, we experience a lot of patients who have had traumatic dental experiences. I don't mean to laugh, but, you know, we get patients that, oh yeah, this, you know, they never really got me numb. And so blah, blah, blah. And we hear those things. And I will tell you, after a while, again, I think the compassion fatigue just kind of sets in where it's like, blah, 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 blah. You know, when you hear these patients say these things, but the reality is if you really want to focus on empathetic care, and I love, Elizabeth, your introduction earlier of Dr. Sanchez and what she does on the ethics side, diversity, inclusion, looking at the entirety of the patient, you know, and delivering highly ethical care. Part of that is reading the patient and being a supportive provider in that. So I will share a few things that we do in dentistry. We follow a model of motivational interviewing. So open-ended questions, you know, but allowing the patient, you know, so it's how does that make you feel? How comfortable are you? What can I do to, you know, some of those types of questions to help the patient feel like you're in a safe space, and I'm going to ask you some questions. Affirmation, you know, a lot of times when patients are sharing about a trauma, they have something they want affirmed. Oh my gosh, that must have been so scary for you. That must have been so concerned. I completely understand why you would feel that way. If it's okay, I want to share another story. This actually occurred about a month after my dad passed. So after our father had passed, you know, in kind of the steps leading up to that, there was a lot of paperwork that had to happen, and the funeral happened, and there was a lot of paperwork we had to fill out with that. And then, you know, dad's estate and all of these things, because our mom had already previously passed. So all of us kids, there are four of us in the family. There was so much paperwork that just had to get filled out. It was so fatiguing. It was so frustrating. So about a month later, I'm working in clinical care, and this woman has to, one of my patients, my 9 o'clock patient, has to update her health history form. And she comes in and she refuses to fill out the paperwork. She was like, you know, irate. So Rita from the front desk comes back, and she's got this like concerned look on her face. And she's like, oh my gosh, your patient refuses to fill out the paperwork. And I'm like, okay, I'll deal with this. So I bring her back, I sit her down, and I'm like, hey, well, I started up at the top with the A's, you know, I'm like, do you have angina? Do you have, you know, arthritis all the way down, right? And, you know, about halfway through, she started crying. And I stopped, and I shut my door, and is everything okay? She said, I'm really sorry. My husband just passed away 3 days ago, and I have just had so much effing paperwork to fill out. I am just so exhausted of filling out paperwork. So of course it's like, oh, I put the clipboard down, and it's like, okay, we don't have to do this today. You know what I mean? And she was just going through the motions. And, you know, I think anybody who's experienced trauma or anything like that, like you go into shock and you're just, you know, and you're just kind of going through the motions and show, oh, I didn't want a cancellation fee. Okay. Mrs. Jones, who would have understood if you canceled your dental cleaning appointment to be here. So of course, you know, not that I'm the hero of the story, but I think there's an opportunity here in what's going out versus just pressing somebody to get what we want out of them. We do this thing at our office where we've got Starbucks gift cards. So I gave her a $10 Starbucks gift card. She's like, I've got all my grown kids coming in town for the funeral and I've got to plan this and da 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 da. And I was like, here's a Starbucks gift card. Go get yourself a coffee and just sit down and just process this. Like I will come in on my day off if we have to see you. Like we will find a way to see you when you're ready, but just go. And again, you know, I think those are the things on the empathy side. I'm not the hero of the story, but the truth is, I think we have the opportunity to be more humanistic and kind and understanding in a lot of these traumatic experiences, which, you know, we don't understand until sometimes it comes out. And to your point, sometimes it doesn't come out. Sometimes the patient doesn't just announce it. They say it in other ways to you. And it's like, something is off with this patient, right?
Yeah, I think sometimes too, like the examples that you've brought up, they're not the things that I usually deal with, right? But if you really think, right, like what we said, what is trauma? Well, trauma is any externally inflicted injury, right? But usually when you think of trauma, right, it's very sudden, it's very acute. And that's what we deal with, right? But that does not mean that being a six-year-old that week after week after week after week needs to have IVIG injections. That's traumatic, right? Yeah. It's not an externally inflicted injury that I deal with, but it doesn't mean that it's not traumatic, right? Your husband dying. Again, even if they died from a chronic illness that you knew, that's still traumatic. So telling somebody that they have cancer, right? A new diagnosis of cancer, I think that's traumatic, right? Mm-hmm. And in my line of work, it's all very acute and unexpected, right? Which I think adds a layer to it, but it doesn't mean that all the other things are not also...
They're far more in shock, I'd imagine, right? When it's unexpected, right? Like that. I mean, I not to go back to like our experience, but for both of our parents, they were not chronic. It was sudden. It was unexpected. Mm-hmm. It was tragic. And so there's that layer of shock is, I mean, you're treating people that are in shock, and people who are in shock do weird things when they're in that fight or flight state of shock, right? I mean, some people it's like, oh, that happened. I guess I need to do the dishes. And you're like, what? Mm-hmm. Because I need control over this one thing because I can't, you know, I mean, all of those little things that happen. So you're you're working alongside experiences like that with your patient. And then I can only imagine too, Dr. Sanchez, that you've got the families rushing in too with this, like, you know, I mean, just panic, and you've got to be the one, right? Sometimes you're the one telling, here's what happened and here's where we are. And then you've got to use your metric system, right? The stable, critical, like all those, right? You've got to give that, and that can either give hope or desperation to a family. I mean, there is just so much that you're involved with. It's really incredible.
I wouldn't say it's incredible. I mean, we're trained for it, right? Like, that's my job.
But that you are meeting humans to what you said earlier, you are meeting humans on the worst day of their life. I mean, you are meeting people where it is not always, but oftentimes something irreversible has just happened to them. Mm-hmm. I would say almost all the time, right? Something irreversible. If you're in a car accident, you get behind the wheel and you get to that same intersection where that car accident happened, you will always think about that, right?
I will say though, it's something that the way that I think about it is that it's a privilege, right? It's a privilege to be the person that gets to take care of that human during the worst day of their lives. It's a huge responsibility, but it's also so meaningful, and I do see it as a huge privilege that I'm the person that gets to try to make things better. And if I can make things better, great. And if I can't make things better, right, if I can't fix whatever the situation is, it's still a privilege to be able to take care of that person and be able to support their loved ones through it. And I think a lot of us think about it that way. And if we didn't, we wouldn't do it. You know, because it's a huge responsibility, but it's an even bigger privilege.
And you said it before that in a very, very short period of time, you have to be the one to gain their trust, but also they don't necessarily have a choice, but they need to trust you to take care of them. And you're absolutely right. It is a privilege. And the fact that you get to do that and that you're there to help them, it's tremendous. Not only them, but also the caregivers. Mm-hmm. And to both of your points, it's an acute setting and it's acute trauma, but we also think about the long term and how they're going to recover from it.
Yeah. This is kind of a funny story. You can cut it out of the podcast if you want later, but
probably not.
So I don't know how to swim. Well, I'm learning how to swim, but I really don't know how to swim. And about 3 or 4 months ago, I was on vacation and I was going to go snorkeling, and I've been snorkeling a bunch of times, but I always wear a life vest. And they assigned me a snorkeling instructor that said, we can't do this with a life vest. You're going to, you know, the sea is there's too many waves. You're going to get seasick. You need to get in the water without a life vest. And I was like, no. I was like, I've done this many, many times before. Just give me a life vest. And he's like, do you trust me? And I'm like, I don't trust. I just met you. Like, of course I don't trust you.
And you were like, in the ocean with a bunch of
waves. Are you in the ocean?
Yeah. This was in the ocean.
You're in the ocean. The Titanic is at the bottom of this thing. No, I don't trust you.
No, but this instructor was like, you know, talking to me and reassuring me. And this is my job. I do this for a living. I've taught many people how to do this. I've snorkeled with a lot of people. You need to trust me. And I was like, no, I do not trust you. I just met you. And then he walked away. And I thought, I ask people that have never met me to trust me every day. And they're not just getting in the ocean. I'm cutting into their bodies while they're unconscious. That's a big deal. And all these patients just need me and trust me because they trust that I'm going to do my job. And I take my job really seriously because these people are putting their trust in. So I thought, okay, I'm going to trust this guy that I just met that's telling me that I'm going to get in the ocean without a life vest. And I'm going to be fine.
You're so brave. You're like, let's go, Rick. We're going.
Guess what?
Snorkeling is no joke, by the way.
This is amazing.
It is so hard.
So you take the life vest off. You're like, we're going to do it. What happens?
I got in the water without a life vest. And within 30 seconds, I was swimming by myself.
Look at you, girl.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But it's not me. It's this guy. That well, knew.
Okay.
That he could get me to be fine in the water without a life vest. And he was with me the whole time. He was like, first he was holding my hand, and then he let go of my hand, and he kept checking in on me, you know. And but I think it was just so, it was the first time that it was really, I was in a situation to put myself in somebody else's hands, right?
Yeah.
That I didn't trust, I'd never met. And I'll say, like, I've had surgery before, right? But it was at my old hospital with the anesthesiologist that I knew and the surgeon that I knew. And, you know, and it's something like, I know how surgeries work. I know what the operating room looks like. I know how, like, I know the system, right? This was completely foreign to me. And that's how all my patients come to me. They come to me and they don't know anything about, and they just have to trust me. It really made me realize, like, I had always appreciated how meaningful it was that these patients trusted me. But all of a sudden, I was on the other side.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it gave me a different perspective, even though obviously snorkeling is nowhere. Like, you cannot compare it to going under the knife, you know, in an emergency setting. But yeah.
I just love the irony that a trauma surgeon was afraid of snorkeling. Like, you're like, all right, let's deal with these gunshot wounds and all this stuff, but snorkeling. But hey, we all have our thing, right? And I think that's the piece, you know. What a refreshing discussion today. I mean, truly, there is no question that you are not only extremely passionate about what you do, but that sense of professional responsibility that you place into your patient care is just so wonderful to see. And I will say, if there was ever a traumatic experience in my family, I would hope that they would be treated by someone like you, who has the ethical and moral compass to do the right thing and to take care of their patients and to have that dialogue. You know, one of the biggest traumas that I think the general public is experiencing right now is the declining trust that they have in the healthcare industry, with how quickly doctors are in and out. Nobody has time anymore to talk to me about anything, and how quickly patients get passed from specialist to specialist, and medications just get added, and the pharmacist is in charge of it, all of these things. And so in this hustle and bustle of the challenges that healthcare has to face in order to rise up to meet the needs and demands of the community. As a trauma surgeon, your job is only going to get more and more busy as our boomers continue to age and have traumatic falls. And, you know, here in Arizona, we got a big problem with, you know, our snowbirds getting in golf carts and riding around after a couple of whiskeys down at the, you know what I mean? And it's like, here we go, you know? And so, I mean, your work is going to continue to evolve to have to meet those needs. And we don't have any time to unpack this today, but our third party payers and the reimbursement rates that we're seeing not commensurate with the level of work, skill, and talent that's needed. And in tandem with that, the third-party payer reimbursement that's not commensurate with what inflation has looked like today in order to actually reimburse for the skills, talents, materials, et cetera, that are needed to deliver the level of care that's necessary for these patients. Again, that's a whole topic for another day. But inside of this, to know that there are still providers like you out there who, despite all of those things, because we don't have a lot of amazing things going for us in the healthcare space, but despite those things, that you show up and you do that because at the end of the day, you are seeing patients at their worst. As a trauma surgeon, you absolutely do. Dr. Sanders, when you're cutting off somebody's toes or you're telling a patient that we need to screen them for diabetes because this thing that they think is just a bloody ulcer is actually a diabetic foot ulcer and they don't have a diagnosis for it. dental professionals listening today, those of you who are seeing patients who have a history of a traumatic experience, what about the patients who have had a terrible experience with a root canal? You know, my implants in the front don't ever feel like my natural teeth. I'm really sensitive. Be careful. These are crowns over here. You know, all of those things are trauma-based reactions, and we have the privilege of working with patients inside of that. And so thank you, Dr. Sabrina Sanchez, for your incredible remarks today and for sharing with us about the privilege that you feel in being able to deliver that. We so appreciate you and thank you for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Of course. Well, with that, friends, thank you for joining the Sanders Sisters for another scintillating episode of All Things Oral Systemic. Please stay tuned next month as we continue the conversation in brushing up on All Things Oral Systemic.
We promise to keep you on your toes.
Cheers.
Thank you for joining us for another monthly episode of Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters.
Thank you for being part of the change we need to see in the medical and dental professions.
Join us next month for another sister-to-sister chat about other unique, interesting, and perhaps provocative and disruptive health topics.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, and maybe even leave a fabulous review.
And we'll catch you next month for another episode of
Floss and Flip Flops
with the Sanders Sisters.
I love you, Kinka.
I love you, Izzy.